Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Well, it's really interesting to me that you highlighted, this is a very wealthy area. We're sitting in Napa Valley, which is one of the most desirable tourist destinations in the world, just not the United States. So the bar has been set quite high.
True.
And there's a lot of brands here that don't need to make money.
No, not at all. They already made their money in technology, and this is a passion project.
So just from a purely practical standpoint, we have corporate ownership, which is a whole other animal. We have vanity ownership, let's call it that.
Yes, I like that.
But it's the truth.
Yes.
And then there's the small business. Mm-hmm. And as a small business, the challenge is, where do I begin?
Oh, yeah.
Just because your name is on the bottle, and by the way, I'm still restraining myself. I'm in front of a lineup of beautiful bottles, and that sparkling, the Charismatic Fool, has been quite delicious. I've been taking sips during conversation. We're definitely going to talk more about it shortly.
Absolutely.
But I really want to focus on what it's like to be in this environment, you know, as a person, but also as a business.
Yeah.
And have this idea of who you are as a brand, you know, what you want to create in terms of value proposition for the consumer, why you made the choices to make this portfolio of wines, why it's, you know, this versus that.
Right.
And also having such an example, so close and personal, of somebody who has also undertaken this journey and, you know, perhaps different trajectory, but, you know, kind of experienced maybe not a meteoric rise, but certainly a formidable trajectory.
Absolutely.
Right? So what was it like for you when you first started and the decisions that you were making as far as what grapes were purchased, what the winemaking decisions are, that whole thing, walk me through it.
Well, it was fairly serendipitous. The person who said to me that, you know, wow, you've been writing for telling other people's story for 12 years, his name was Matt Carney, and he's a musician.
Oh.
And his manager also went to school with the CFO. I was a frat brother of the CFO of Whole Foods. And so when I sort of responded and thought about it and was like, well, you know, I'm not thinking about making a wine. He's like, Matt said, but why don't we make a wine together? Like, yeah, sure, whatever, you know, it's a musician. I'm interviewing him for Wine Enthusiast at that point. It's like, yeah, whatever. And I talked to John, and John and I talked about making a wine called The White Project. Well, I got a call from his manager saying, hey, Matt said he talked to you about making a wine. This is something we're really seriously interested in. I'm going to call my buddy at Whole Foods and see if there's something we can do. And I was thinking,
was this a prank call?
Yeah. Are you serious? Wow. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And so we jumped on the phone, and I told John, I was like, hey, listen, I know we're talking about doing something with just me, but this might be able to fund our winery. Because at that point, John didn't have the funds either. We had the grapes, but not the funds. He was farming the grapes. And so we talked on the phone, and Whole Foods said, yeah, actually, we have a spot in our top 10 holiday national program. We're looking for a red blend at this price point with this flavor profile. And so we approached John's family, the Truchard family, and said, hey, what do you have in terms of grapes? And they had this amazing Merlot, and John was growing some other grapes, and we had some other grapes, and we pulled it all together. John and his little team of two people and I pulled this deal together, and we ended up signing the deal. Steve Smith, to come to the story later, was Matt Carney's manager, working for Greg Latterman. Greg was the one who knew the person from Whole Foods. Steve worked underneath him. So Steve was working at the ground level with me, arguing the contract between John and my new winery and Matt Carney and Whole Foods. And so the two of us were united in some fronts and opposites in others. And we were able to pull this deal together with Whole Foods. So originally what it was is one special project wine for 50 states, or 48 states, I think. But anyway, many states, that was designed and made specifically for a price point and flavor profile that Whole Foods was looking for. And Matt Carney was going to tour around the country playing at the Whole Foods. And it was all a beautiful thing. And it took us 7 years to get paid. So it was right off the bat, we started to see problems there. Also, Whole Foods, as wonderful as a system as it is, that they are such a ground-up, or were such a ground-up company, we came in at a national level. And so the individual stores rejected our wine. They said, we don't want, the national's telling us we have to carry this. We're buying the minimum amount and we're hiding it in the dust bucket in the back.
Oh my.
So our first wine was shunned by all the individual stores because it was mandated by the national. And so our work to get those stores not to hide our wine was intense and ultimately a failure. And so it took us so much work to get that wine. Not to mention, John didn't have distribution in 50 states. We had to find distributors who were willing to carry this wine. We're making all these promises about how much we're going to sell. We got 5,000 case deal. This is going to be fantastic. And guess what? They brought in 3 cases and they hid them. So these distributors are like, so you made all these promises. We paid more in licensing for these brands or for your Little Version Chorus brand than we made. And we're not happy with you. So here was John's name being sullied. Here was my first endeavor in the wine industry costing money instead of making money. And here's Matt, whose career was taking him into all these concert halls and away from the Whole Food. So he was unable to do a lot of the Whole Food things that we expected too. So it was a bit of a debacle, but it was an amazing experience in that I learned how distribution worked. I learned when things work well, what does it look like? Because some of the Whole Food stores really loved the wine and they loved Matt Carney, and he went out and he played one time. He was there for like 8 hours signing bottles. Wow. We also learned that we had to do one bottle signed per person because fans were wanting 2 cases signed. So I learned so many valuable lessons. We learned that a wine, no matter how good it is, if it's associated with a musician, people are going to buy one bottle and they're going to put it on their shelf. They're probably not going to come back and buy more. So you have to be very careful about your business model and your choice. And so it was an amazing learning experience. But that was actually what drove our original wine project, was a crime of opportunity and being able to have the resources and the people around me, John, the Truchard family, with the grapes and the ability to help me with this deal and make a wine that fit the profile that Whole Foods desperately needed.
So you essentially started with marketing.
Yeah.
It was custom made for specific, so.
Yeah.
Once you recovered from that, mm-hmm. what did you do next?
We decided, at this time there were very few celebrity wines, we decided that the problem was that Matt's name was too big. We loved the idea of working with people of note, but we didn't want to work with a celebrity. So we started working with Jacko Pierce. They are a very well-known band. If you grew up in Texas and happened to be in college in the late 80s and early 90s, they are like the Jack Johnson, if you will, okay. of Texas of that period
Until
of time.
They come up?
Ubiquitous. And they played at all the colleges. And now those people had grown up and they're all lawyers and successful people living in Houston and on Dallas and all over the place and traveling all over the country to see Jacko Pierce and these destination shows in the Hamptons and all these wonderful areas. I met them at a music event. I was writing an article. At that point, I was doing a 20-page section of Napa Valley Life, writing and editing. I had other writers supporting me as well on that. But I was at Live in the Vineyard, and I was interviewing Jacko Pierce, and they were talking about it, and they said, you know, we made a wine at one point. I was like, really? They're like, yeah, we made like 10 cases of Pinot, and we sold it out in 2 seconds. I was like, did you then?
Oh my.
Let me hear more, a little bit more about that. And they started talking about it. And so I ended up going to one of their concerts in Santa Barbara, visit a friend down there, listened to the band, really saw what they did, and sat at a table and started talking to all the people around me. I said, hey, did you get to try that Jacko Pierce wine they made? And they said, we didn't, but my God, we wish we had. And I said, well, did you? Do you then? And so I approached them, and we launched a Pinot called Weather. With Jacko Pierce, because Weather was a song of theirs that was really meaningful, and also Weather has a profound impact, especially on Pinot Noir grapes. And so we ultimately made a wine with them that was for Texas only. This time, rather than going after 50 distributors or Whole Foods, we had one distributor, and we had a band that was local and willing to really... Matt was willing, he just wasn't able. Mm-hmm. A band that was willing and able to support the wines. And
yep.
So the brand blew up in Texas. It was wonderful. And so... Not long after, though, you started to see celebrity wines pop up everywhere. And that business model that we used, you know, disintegrated. Before it disintegrated, however, we made a wine with Amy Hanailii, who's the official musician of the Hawaiian Islands. Mm-hmm. And so we ended up making 3,000 cases of wonderful wine with Amy in the Hawaiian Islands. That's still out there. She still has a wine brand. But what we, you know, again discovered is that her fans were only willing to buy one bottle, she'd get it signed, and put it on the shelf. So... only so much growth. Also for us, constantly having to make wines that other people wanted us to make, do things that other people wanted us to do, change flavor profiles because a musician feels like it should be drier or sweeter or whatever the case may be. It felt disingenuous. We were making we had these wonderful grapes and these wonderful wines that were being viewed as tchotchkes and viewed as promotional products. And so mm-hmm. we just said, enough of that. Let's move away from doing that. Now, we do still make wines with musicians because our background and connections are so strong, but rather than making them partners, what we do is we make a wine with them. They'd help us develop the wine and the label as much as they're able, and then we donate a large portion of it back to charity, and a charity that's very close to them. And as we try through the wines, we can speak more about that. But we haven't completely abandoned the idea of making wines with people who we love and who we celebrate in the music world, but certainly the business model where we're trying to blow them out to Whole Foods or even capture one state where they're more popular is something that for us, it just felt disingenuous. It was just another product for the band at the end of the day, because their true love and calling is music. And for us, here we are making these beautiful wines that weren't being judged as the wine or the quality, for the wine or quality that we were making, but rather by the label that said some band's name on it.
What was your wine drinking life like? What were you consuming during those years?
I was drinking a lot of Scout's Honor. That's made by Kirk Van Yee.
Yeah.
It's just one
Niels
of my.
Yeah.
Kirk makes Scout.
It.
Yeah, Kirk does.
Niels. So, but back then, was it Niels or no?
No, it wasn't. That's always been
his. I didn't even know that.
Niels, he's actually in my Napa Valley Men's Luncheon Club with me. I've drinking many. He started with Groff, actually, the first 100 point Niels, and the first 100 point wine in Napa Valley was Groff.
I had no idea Scout's Honor was solely his son's brand.
It was, it is. And so Van Yee was really one of the first things that I gone to. Kirk is a dear friend. Schoolhouse Vineyards became my absolute favorite. They're right up the street from my house, and their Mescalon's a blend. They're Pinot Noir out of St. Helena. I play rugby with Dwayne Hoff, the owner of Fantesca.
Yes.
While I couldn't really afford to drink much of those wines, all great things or all good things, whatever it may be. The red blend became a favorite of mine. I was drinking a lot of Peugeot because my wife. Family owns a winery in Rutherford called Peugeot.
Uh-huh.
I was drinking a lot of jam and butter and John Anthony wines. So I was drinking the wines of made by the people who I knew and loved in the valley.
Yeah.
And while as a writer I would travel and get many samples and things like that, I would certainly write about those and enjoy those. Yeah. It was really at the end of the day, it was about knowing the people that were making the wines and having those experiences that I could then share and say, you have to go visit these people or this family, because not only are the wines wonderful, they're coming from people who are kind and who are making a difference in the valley, and this is a genuine expression of their artisanry and their love for what they do. This is not just a passion project or a vanity winery. This is this is truly the heart and soul of the valley, and I loved drinking and sharing those wines.
That makes a lot of sense. So when that mental shift occurred, when you wanted to really start with the integrity of the wine that you're making and then move into the distribution part of it. You obviously had easy access, well, I shouldn't say easy, you had access to grapes.
Yes.
Clearly, naturally, but you still had to make some very specific choices.
Yes.
As to what is it that you're doing.
Yes.
So how did that develop?
It began with that vineyard that I first mentioned that I said, tell John, I'm going to buy those grapes and make a wine. Well, it started with that, actually, and that's a vineyard that I could hit with a stone from my house. See, my four-year-old might even be able to. And it is surrounded by some of the best Cabernet in Napa Valley, Spotswood, and right at the base of Spring Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And it was planted to Merlot. And it was just this amazing, bold, spicy, heavy Merlot in a world of so many watery and weak Merlots. And so we began with that source and using that Merlot as both a blender and as an individual grape and wine itself. And being that it was a sense of place right near my home, John was farming it. It was all the genuine things that we wanted. Now, certainly buying grapes, even buying bulk juice, that's a part of the process, and it's a beautiful part of the process. It's like painters aren't sitting around making their own paint. You don't judge their painting as any less because they didn't blend their paint. They went to the paint store and bought paint, right? So there's nothing wrong at all with that, and it's certainly something that we do with our wines. But that vineyard gave us the availability to do everything from vine to bottle, to be out there, to watch bud break, to pick berries as they grew, to farm everything ourselves. And so that really became, and at some level, still is the heart and soul. Every single wine that you see, almost, rather, actually in front of you, I'm going to take that back. It isn't in front of these ones, but in the majority of our wines, that there's a piece of that. our single vineyard Merlot, specifically from there, which was written recently about the Robb Report, is Merlot making a comeback, and this is why, and there are pictures of me holding the bottle in that vineyard.
How cool is that?
It was exciting, and it is exciting, but it was that vineyard that really got us started. It was also, as you said, access to fruit, and knowing it was fruit that John farmed, or fruit that his family farmed. Yeah. And so, you know, being able to do that, and our first winemaker, Brian Brakesman, his family has a Summit Lake Vineyards, and so being able to use his resources, another guy I play rugby with, that's where I found him. But all these local boys with local connections, and really, even if we weren't the ones growing the grapes, having a direct human connection with the people who were growing them.
Yeah, absolutely. So Merlot is really the cornerstone, the foundation. The first year you made one wine?
Yes, first year we made one wine is a Cabernet Merlot blend.
Perfect. Which year was that?
The first, 2011 is when we started the company. I believe the first vintage was 2012.
That's a good vintage to start on.
Yes, it was. It certainly was.
And delicious.
It was, and 13 was a little more pungent, but also still a wonderful vintage. And it's been for us, it's been a great ride. A lot of consistency in what we've been able to do despite growth because of the people we know and what we do.
So how did your portfolio grow from that single bottling in 2012? How many wines did you make in 13?
13, we brought it up. At that point, we were doing Weather Pinot Noir, we were doing Versincoris Red Blend, Napa Valley Red Blend, and we were also doing a Sauvignon Blanc. And that was Versincoris Sauvignon Blanc. So we had those three wines, followed in late 2013, by the Hanai Ali'i Merlot. Okay. And that Hanai Ali'i Merlot was followed by the Hanai Ali'i Chardonnay. Okay. And so we then had five wines in our portfolio, and through a bit of a serendipitous situation, we also ended up with a reserve Pinot Noir, because Carrie is the lead singer from Jacko Pierce, had a relationship with a vintner who had some extra Pinot. And so it was much more expensive and just gorgeous, and so we ended up making a reserve wine out of that. So ultimately, very quickly, went from one wine to six. And it was absolutely overwhelming, and it was more than we could handle, and we ended up, that was another reason, not just that we didn't love being the guys making tchotchke wines, if you will, we also suddenly had six of them.
Yeah. So how did you handle, you mentioned earlier that you were involved in production, you have obviously a winemaker record, but you also very much learned in the job, is that? I understand. And a curious creature like you, I can't imagine you wouldn't want to be in every aspect of it.
Yes. No, probably annoyingly so, ultimately. absolutely no. From the very beginning, I was involved in going out to the vineyards. I was then involved in every last bit of the blending process and understanding what it was. As a writer, I was offered to take many classes at the CIA. I accepted all of those opportunities. I began to travel to Italy, especially if it wasn't just visits to wineries, but rather experiences where you got to be a part of harvest. I was immersed in what was happening in my wife's family's winery. And so for me, it was about putting my hands on everything and doing everything. He's like, oh, I've just got to blend a couple things together and bring it down to you. It's like, no, I'll come to your house if I have to. I want to be there. I want to see what you're blending. I want to see where it came from. I want to see what it is. I want all the romance that I see in these vineyards that I'm out frolicking in. I want to see the stuff that comes in a test tube. I want to understand all of this stuff because there's a lot of science in there. Well, I say test tube, I should say beaker, but whatever, you know, it's a very scientific process too. And I wanted to see all of that. So starting with, you know, John's first winemaker, Robb Lloyd, helped us with our first project. And then we moved on and we worked with Brian Brakesman. From there, Jeff Kandarian, each of them with different skills, different abilities, different focuses, different backgrounds, and really understanding who they were, why they did what they did, what they learned when they went to school, and then really just bugging the hell out of them. I was, wait, why'd you do that? What is that? What's that stuff? Wait, is that concentrate? It's not concentrate. What is that? Why are you doing that? He's like, oh, why are you putting oak in that? That's like an oak dropper. I don't want a bunch of fake oak. He's like, we're doing this because we want to see what's going to happen if we put this on oak for years. No, we are not going to dump a bunch of oak flavoring into the final wine. But what you need to understand, Ian, is that if we choose the oak profile or program that you're suggesting of new American oak for this Pinot Noir, this is what you're going to get. And I would taste like, oh my God, this is awful. He's like, right. So that's why we've got the beaker and the dropper. So you can understand that while to you it seems like it's going to be cool to have this big, powerful Pinot Noir, this Napa Valley style, what you're going to get is a Frankenstein and not one that walks and talks. It's just going to curl up in a ball. And so let's not do that. And so it was, you know, forcing my ideas, learning what were good ideas and bad. Our California Red Blend that is it's just been great for us because a lot of people believe it's a much more expensive wine when they try it than it is. So the Ritz-Carlton serves it at the residences for the residents. And the reason they do that is because the residents are very picky about the wines that are served, and the Ritz is very picky about how much money they spend on them. So they're able to buy our Red Blend and serve it. Everybody's happy, and our Red Blend's only an $18 bottle of wine. So it is this wonderful transition wine. Like, this is great. I can't believe it's only 18 bucks. We want to try everything else. And so, you know, but that wine, to circle back to what I was saying, I said, I want this to be Zinfandel and Syrah. I had this deal with this great family on Syrah that we work with all the time, the McConnell family, who have Ravino Vineyards. And we farm with them. We do everything with them when it comes to Syrah and Cab Franc. We just love them as people. They follow the same practices we do with farming. We're able to be completely involved in every step of the process if we want to be. We found a lot of times we don't need to be because we're so lockstep in the way that we do things. But I said, I want this blended with a Zinfandel. And our consulting winemaker said, yeah, that's more of an Australian thing. And I think Zinfandel is not going to work here. What we want to do is probably do a Cab Franc and Cabernet, and that'll make it bolder. And I said, I hear what you're saying. I'm thinking Zinfandel. He's like, okay, we're going to do one of these again. Well, we blended some Zinfandel in there. Ended up being 75% Syrah, 25% Zinfandel. And what happened was, is a little bit of bitterness that we had in our Syrah at the end became this fruit-forward, zesty, playful wine that didn't lose any complexity. It didn't start to become a Cabernet blend. It didn't get the greenness of Cab Franc, although this vintage we did put Cab Franc in. But the previous vintage we did not. What it became was this fun, dusty, playful, bold, complex, layered California red blend. And the reason was is the Syrah had all those brooding coffee flavors and all that just heavy intensity. And the Zinfandel had that zip and that fun and that exactly the joy at some level that we needed to make this wine. And all those different layers, all those different fun experiences put together created a very special wine. And so I was told I was wrong, and let's skip that and let's do what everybody else is doing. And in that case, I was right. And so sometimes I'm right, sometimes I'm wrong, sometimes I'm right and I still need help, sometimes I'm completely wrong and there's absolutely no help out there for me.
It's all about, like you said, risk taking, trial and error, actually putting yourself out there. You just don't know how it's going to work out, but I think you have to have that chutzpah. Otherwise you'll never know.
And you have to be willing to fail. I've done more failing than anybody probably should ever have to endure, but along the road, as long as you're willing to fall down and get back up and say, okay, well, that was expensive, both emotionally and to my pocketbook, but now I know what not to do, and I'm going to go back, and I'm going to do it right this time. And even if that time you don't do it right, you can't run away, because one of the things I did far too much early in my career was give up. This isn't working, let's try something else. And rather than use what we learned from that first thing, I would jump to a new industry or a new product or a new idea or a new article, rather than really digging into what I did wrong, why it was wrong, how can I fix it and stay on the path that I'm on. I mean, I can't be any happier with the path that I landed on, but I think that a lot of my failures in the past were due to not being curious enough, not being willing to change enough, not willing to be able to get back up and get back on the same path. You know, whether it was fear or insecurity or ADD, I don't know. but now in the wine industry, it's something that I'm absolutely dedicated to. When we make a mistake, learning from it, growing from it, and making the best possible wines and telling the best possible stories and letting people be a part of the stories. That's what we want.
I think that's beautifully said. And wine, I think by definition, it's raised. It takes a while to grow the vineyard. I mean, it's the craft of patience. Mm-hmm. Even if you're not a very patient person, I'm not referring to you specifically, but if one isn't given that gift, it teaches you that.
Yeah.
And I think what you said, I really want to highlight it because it's so instructive. You know, we're both in, I'm still currently in the communication business. Mm-hmm. And you talked about going deep as opposed to linear.
Yeah.
And, you know, we often complain in today's state of affairs how fleeting everything is, and there's that lack of depth, and everybody wants to highlight the surface like stuff because they think that's all people care about. Mm-hmm. But they just want to see that moment in time
click
exactly. And I think we've become driven by that, And the danger for people that are serious about it is that you get very discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to stay the course when there's so many distractions.
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
But I still think what you said holds true today, just like it did then.
Yeah.
You know, don't be afraid to go deeper. Don't be afraid to be unpopular or, you know, maybe more stated, as opposed to all the selfie-driven culture, which also translates into writing.
Yeah.
Take a risk.
Yeah.
And dig deep.
Yeah, and stick with it. Don't let failure scare you. Let it empower you.
Yeah.
It really, you know, and the only way a failure truly is a failure is if you let it be. Otherwise, it's an opportunity. Yeah. I mean, there's no opportunity that's as beautiful as a mistake.
Wow. Teachable moment.
Hopefully. Or I'm waxing poetic and everybody's is this guy talking about? Loses everything.
This is wisdom right there. And we haven't even had a proper glass of wine yet and it's already flowing over. So music.
Yes.
We're sitting downtown Napa in this beautiful space that's very hip and happening. Very contemporary, popping colors.
Yes.
You know, I can tell it was designed very deliberately.
Oh, yeah.
So you said the music has been basically permeating the fabric of your life from the very beginning.
Absolutely.
This is current state, but take us back to the beginning of how you came to love music and practice it.
I owe a lot of that to my stepfather, Gary. He has this had this massive CD collection, and he would play music for us and music videos for us, and he would ask us to play him music. And it wasn't just about the music. He would tell stories about why the music was important to him and ask us to do the same. And so it was a way as a family to really connect around the music that we were listening to. You know, he would talk about his experiences with the Rolling Stones. I would talk about LL Cool J. Whatever it was, we would share that as a family. And I was doing a lot of skateboarding, a lot of things of that nature, and just being a kid. And he and my mom came to me and they said, "We appreciate all this love and effort you're putting into skateboarding and also video games and also seemingly just sitting there a lot. What we'd like you to do is actually do something that you can get better at and turn into a career. We understand you're good at skateboarding, but you know, a lot of kids your age are professional skateboarders now and you are not. So we'd either like you to play an instrument or shave your legs and join the swim team." And it's like, ain't nobody shaving their legs around here, man. That is not what is happening. I am absolutely not going to shave my legs. And did not. And still have not ever shaved my legs. But I did not. And so I picked up the guitar. And my best friend did it at the same time, Adam Satriano, who is actually now a writer for the New York Times.
He's
a correspondent over in London. And so I picked up the guitar and I started learning every Counting Crow song I could. At that time, August and Everything Ever After had just come out. I still think it's one of the greatest albums of all time. Let's like try and find a bad song on that album. Try and find a lyric in a song that isn't meaningful to you. And so we started a band. My dad was dating a woman named Leslie who had been in bands her whole life, and she helped me pick out all the coolest music stuff and the right guitars. And my dad, I started taking guitar lessons. And Adam and I started playing live music, and we had so many friends and people who were willing to come out and endure the painful crap that we were putting out there that there was very little room to stand in these little places we were playing. And so my dad's girlfriend said, "You need to name your band." And they're like, "Yeah, we think we're going to call it the Poppies." And she was like, "Oh God, really? Can you not? I mean, first of all, there's a drug reference there. Whether you know it or not, you're talking about opiates, okay? So you're in junior high. Let's not, or high school, I think, at that point. Let's steer away from the Poppies." It's like, what I see, pick something that you see around you. And I misunderstood what the word limerick meant. I was like, well, we're like a bunch of limericks. We're no deep poems. She's like, a limerick is not a deep poem. There's Once Was a Man from Nantucket followed. I realized quickly that was not going to be the name of our band. She said, check it out, guys. Something that's right in front of you. Look it. Nobody can get into your teeny little gigs here. There's standing room only. There, your name's SRO, standing room only. And we went,
wow.
Cool, man. And so we started a band called Standing Room Only. Picked up a guy named Jeff Jernigan, an amazing singer and songwriter. Got a drummer named Bob Kowalski, who is a heavy metal drummer. And my God, we would play the softest song. He would still have the double kick drum going crazy. nonstop. So, but that kind of taught me to, that taught me a lot about being able to play with different egos. We had two singers, both wanting to write the songs. I was wanting to write the songs. I was wanting to play the solos. The rhythm guitarist wanted to play the solos. And being able to compromise in music is huge. And being able to change immediately in music is huge, to be able to see what's going on. The guy next to you, the guy on the bass, his hand is getting really tired. What can you do to pick up? The drummer's off track. What can you do with your guitar to hide whatever that may be? How can you collaborate? How can you change on the spot? What can you do? Very similar, by the way, to winemaking, actually, in terms of the collaborative efforts of working with different people. And so, and then a drummer who's just like, I mean, he doesn't even know anybody else is in the room. He's just banging on things, and he was an incredible drummer.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palette Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.